radical, where did some of your ideas develop from at that early age?
I would say that they developed from life, pure and simple. Because when I sit down at our Sabbath evening meal and the next day, when I see her mother had a portion out not only the chicken, a half a chicken for 8 people, that's what it amounted to for 2 meals. And when I saw that even the soup that she made out, it had to be on and on and on. And when I started to think that someday when I will be married, I'm going to take a can of salmon and I'll eat it all myself, because whenever we got salmon in the house, it was a delicacy, and we'd get a little bit of it. And that applied to other kinds of food that our youngsters crave, that I would get my fill of it. And also, young as I was, I saw that people did live better than my folks did. And I thought that my parents were as good as any, as the slogan was one time about butter, as good as the best and better than the rest. And that's what I thought about my folks. So I say that came about from life itself. And then having met these people that was formed at local in the union.
Now, were they socialists?
Pardon?
Was the union organizer a socialist?
I couldn't tell you because I didn't know anything about that. I got things on the piecemeal scale. I'd hear about a speaker in town, a man or a woman. I heard about Emma Goldman one time speaking. And that meeting was organized as though you were organizing a conspiracy of something, of some kind. And who the person who helped organize that meeting succeeded in getting an upstairs, an upper room that was housed in an empty building that was cold. And there were things scattered all over the floor, I think ladders and different things, and no chairs or tables. And from that meeting, I recall only one thing about what Emma Goldman said, and that was when we got there and we started to sit on a rickety ladders and so on, and at that we were crowded. We drew crowds because it's probably the only meeting in the city at that time. And at that time, I didn't know whether Emma Goldman was Jewish or Irish or what have you. I didn't know the difference. But I wanted to hear what she had to say. And all I remember about her talk was, well, let's get started. You know, we are used to being crowded, and we are used to being cold, and we are used to being uncomfortable. And I liked what she said. I like what you said, but anyhow, I don't know whether you know very much about her, but she was a firebrand. She was a very good speaker. Later years, I got to know her. She was a very excellent speaker. And another time, I learned of a meeting. Somehow, everything was upstairs. You had to go on an upstairs to everything. Well, Cleveland is that way, you know, take here, there. No, well, we have, I know in Phoenix there are no steps. At any rate, that was in an upstairs, and I'm trying to recall. I don't know what they were talking about. I came there, they were already seated, and they were talking about certain things. And I wanted to take the floor. I had my hand up. I had something to say. And the chairman just passed on to others, called on others, and so forth. And finally, I stood up. After I raised my hand, he didn't stood up. And I started to talk. I said, look, does everybody who comes up here have to wear blue overalls? Don't you recognize people who don't wear blue overalls? don't you recognize people who wear skirts, who wear a dress? And I was real mad and just started to laugh a little bit, you know. I said my say, and I don't even remember what it was about, but I felt I knew the subject they were talking about, mm-hmm. and I wanted to talk. And when I got through talking, I think I got applause out of my...
How old were you then?
Oh, I must have been 16 or 17. Mm-hmm. And
but you were quite conscious of the fact that it was because you were female that you were being passed over?
I wasn't conscious. I just felt that way, see. I did not know, because I don't remember whether I saw any women there. I don't even recall having seen women. If I did, they must have been adults, mm-hmm. you know. But what they were talking about was something that concerned me, concerned my life, you know. And, of course, they got a laugh out of it. And he said, go ahead, talk, little girl. Talk, little girl, you know. I was so mad at him when he said it because I wasn't little. At any rate, trying to think of some, I had a few things that I recalled, and now it doesn't come to me that's outstanding.
But your first
is outstanding,
exposure you know. To an ideological position was to anarchism then.
To what?
To anarchism was your first exposure.
In later years, I learned her philosophy, that is anarchism, but I never was, I never went along with anarchists except in later years when I got interested in the Sacco Vanzetti case, mm-hmm. I learned that they were anarchists, and of course I learned that they were very swell people, mm-hmm. and that they were executed, they were murdered, there's mm-hmm. no other thing to say about it, but that they were murdered. So, but in later years is when I learned these things. I'm trying to recall. Well, let me move on a little bit, get away from the cigar makers.
Well, let me ask.
Yeah.
After the Bernstein factory moved out of the central Cleveland area, did you then continue to work?
I continued to work in the factory, and the name does not come to me. But it was a large factory, and they employed a lot of cigar makers there. A lot of cigar makers. I felt quite elevated there. But they had four ladies and four men there, and I...
Was it a union shop then?
Huh?
Was it a union shop?
No, ma'am. It was not a union shop. It was a... big industrial outfit. I'm trying to recall where I went to work from there, still another factory, in the hope of getting better returns mm-hmm. for what I was making.
What was your expectation of what your life was going to be like at that point?
I thought that when it got to be so that I didn't have to turn in all my money to the house budget, when I could save my own money, that I would go to night school and do what people do when they are younger than I was at that time. And I had no idea exactly what, if anything, I would be, but I will go to this and tell you how I got to be what I got to be. In addition to what we did to help, Mother used to have rumors from time to time to help things along, to enable her to give us better food and better clothing, better things, you know. And I recall one time while I was still working in the factory, one or two men came and she rented a room to them. And I was a little surprised that they came to live there while our house was very poor, because I was very clean. Mm-hmm. Mother didn't do the housekeeping. She did the cooking, but we kids, we girls, did the cleaning. And so Mother said that day when I came home from work, to do this and that and the other thing in that room, because there were two roomers coming in from New York. I said, from New York? Well, she says, they are important people. They are manufacturers. They manufactured rooms. Brooms and brushes they manufacture. And they're on business. I don't know how long they will be here, but whatever it is will help us, you know. So cleaned up, scrubbed up the floor. There were no carpets in the house. And cleaned up the place and that is that. And they came. And there were two young men. To me, they didn't look young. Later I learned that they were young, although I think one was 24. The other one was younger. But they looked to me like men that I'd have nothing to do with, because they looked like older people. At any rate, they were very nice, they were very friendly, and we didn't see much of them. They'd come to the rooms and away come back. And then in the evening, in the front room, I don't remember, there must have been newspapers in those days, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. They'd read newspapers, and they started to talk a little bit about their business. And they found out that I was working in the factory, car factory. Well, one day, of all things, one of the guys, this older one, the one that is, I think, 24 years old, said, I will walk with you to your work, to your place of work. I said, what for? You know, I didn't know. Well, he says, I want to see Cleveland. You can see Cleveland a while, so I want to see. All right, see Cleveland, that's fair enough. So we walked, and we reached a place, a certain street, I don't remember, Euclid Avenue, what street it was, where they were laying new sidewalks, either a new sidewalk or new seminary repair, mm-hmm. street repair, and there was a temporary walk, see. So one person at a time could walk. And the parents, I don't know what still is, at that time it must have been politeness on the gentleman's part to let the lady walk the front. And so he stopped for a moment. He says, just go ahead. And I thought to myself, you fool, I can break my neck on this. Why don't you try first? But later I realized that that's the way a man walked with women. You know, I should know that business, man walk with women. So I walked until we reached the sidewalk again. And that was that. And it led me to the factory, and he went back home, and I went about my business. And then they left. They went back for New York, and I started being bombarded with mail from this person, the older fellow of the two. Love letters, all kinds of love letters. Well, one day, a letter came, and the family, when a letter would come from New York, they'd run to give me the letter. I was on my hands and knees scrubbing the floor, scrubbing the big floor, I think to the kitchen floor. And here, don't you want it, don't you want it? I says, no, it'll wait. They said, it won't dry up, the floor will dry up, I've got to finish it, you know. I didn't do one of those love letters. At any rate, I married this man, his name was Archie Land. Actually, we got married after some time. He came back to Cleveland, and
how much older was he than you?
Well, he was four, I think, 4 years older than I was by the time we got married. You know, he was 24. Mm-hmm. But at that time when he came there, it was about 2 years prior to that. I don't remember at any rate, because I know I wasn't 20 at that time yet. At any rate, it was about, I must have been about 20 years old when I got married. And someone said to him one time, what ever made you leave New York, where the quote, girls to burn, you could get a girl who had a rich parents, rich father. Why did you come here? He says, huh, what do you people know about a girl? I walked with her shortly after I came to Cleveland, and he named the place where we walked on that narrow walk, and I walked ahead. And here they used to call it petticoat, you know, a slip.
Mm-hmm.
They used to call, and her petticoat was showing, and it was white as snow. And I said to myself, I must get that girl. I must get that girl. So that is the interesting story about how ultimately, at any rate, well, after I got married, had two children, two boys, and I would say the best time of my life was when these boys used to come home from school, and I used to have fun with them in no short way. I loved to be with them and pretend that I am one of them, a kid themselves, and we used to have a lot of fun, you know. And they considered that a part of their life. They wanted it.
You were living in much more comfortable circumstances.
When we were married?
When you were married.
When we were married, my husband went to work as a conductor. Oh, incidentally, they went out of business.
Mm-hmm.
That factory didn't work. They went out of business. So he went to work as a conductor, and they'd all teach me. I know why you married Archie. You married the uniform. I says, yes. I married the uniform, and he married the white petticoat. Well, there's times for humor in spite of all this thing, you know. And, yes, we lived very nicely. We always, come to think of it, we always lived financially better than the neighbors around us. We were, wherever we lived, we were always considered wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
That is, my husband and I
mm-hmm.
considered wealthy because we always had a nice home. And as I recall it, I had a policy not to buy anything on the installment plan. So when we started furnishing the house, we furnished a little bit at a time, just what we needed, like things in the kitchen and the bedroom. And on and on and on,
mm-hmm.
but it was always nice, it was always pleasant. So much so that when my mother's brother came visiting the United States, and he was quite a wealthy man back where he came from, they had a servant and different things, that kind of, I knew about it. So when he came, he naturally came visiting mother because his sister, so he lived with her, but he came to visit
mm-hmm.
me, and when he came, I set up, I think, some tea and cookies and something in the dining room. So he said, he talks in Yiddish, he says, Varum, why? I said, the dining room, it's pleasant. That's not Zober Kirch. Zober is clean. You have a clean kitchen, you know. So I knew he was well impressed, and so we always lived well there. However, when the children started growing up, I got to thinking it was time for me to think about myself, because I stopped when I didn't get anywhere. I didn't get anywhere. And I felt the children, I think Jerry was about 8 years old and Sandy was 4 years old. I could go to school, and when Archie comes home from work, he can be with the children. He can babysit the children. And so I did. I started going to night school. And it was like being reborn, except not on the farm, not milking cows, not in the grime of the garden, but actually school and coming home to a nice family, and I enjoyed my night school very much. And finally, reached a night high school. I finished my credits and got all my credits in the high school, and I took 2 years to get my college degree, the last 2 years of my college degree. I went 4 years. I took that at night also.
At Baldwin, what school was that?
Baldwin. It was State High. It was called State High, and it was affiliated with Baldwin College.
Mm-hmm.
So the first 2 years I took this, and the second 2 years I took my college last credits. I went to college, and the first 2 years of law school. So for 2 years I had. For 2 years, I had two schools.
Mm-hmm. How did you decide upon law?
All right, now, how did I decide on law is very good. During the World War, I don't know whether we were in the war yet, it was 17 or 18, mm-hmm. I attended the meetings, Eugene V. Mm-hmm. Debs came to Cleveland to hold an anti-war meeting, and I listened to him, to his speeches. While the children were in school, I managed to take in those meetings, which was in the daytime, and I was very much impressed with this man and with what he's doing. And the second time that he came for another anti-war meeting, before he started talking, he was nabbed. He was arrested. He was arrested, and I think the charge was, I forget now what the charge was. I think sabotaging the war, mm-hmm. because in his speech he made this statement to the audience. He says, "Mothers," addressing himself to the women, "mothers, you did not raise your sons to be used for cannon fodder." And that statement impressed me very well, because what happens with boys when they go to war? I was anti-war all my life anyhow, as far as I could think, mm-hmm. back as I could think. And this is what was happening. The boys haven't had anything to say. They just have to go. And then many of them don't come back. And many who do come back wish they never did come back, mm-hmm. the condition they're in. So on the day his trial opened up, I arranged to get my children off to school, you know, off to school, and I went downtown to the courthouse to listen to the Debs trial. My impression was, number one, that the jury was made up of middle-class farmers. I was old enough to know these mm-hmm. things. Middle-class farmers, the way they answered their questions and the way they were interrogated and so forth. Number two, my impression was that the lawyer who defended him was frightened to death for fear of being labeled a socialist, because he was representing Debs.
Mm-hmm.
Debs was a socialist. And I followed that trial throughout. And when the prosecutor made his closing summation, And Debs made the argument on his own behalf for himself, and I knew that he impressed the jury very much. And he said, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the prosecutor is correct. I did make the statement, and I would not be I if I denied that statement, or if I did not take credit. I consider that credit, to my credit, to make the statement I did, not only to make it, but to mean it. And I ask you, and I'm not expecting you to answer that question. Maybe you can answer it by your verdict. But to yourself, ask yourself, did you raise your sons, those of you who have sons, did you raise them to go to war and be brought back in a box, or not be brought back at all, or be brought back crippled? Isn't that raising your boys to be cannon fodder, you know?" And it was very dramatic when he made that statement. Now, when the prosecutor made the prosecution had the opening and the closing, so after he talks, the defense can't talk anymore. So the prosecutor made his closing statement. You see this man? He's genteel, isn't he? He's a kindly gentleman, isn't he? And all with sarcasm in his voice. And you heard him, didn't you? Now you see how dangerous this man is? He is so dangerous because he gets a following. And ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I have more respect for you than to be influenced by so dangerous a person. Your duty is to find him guilty and remove him from his position of misleading other people. You know. And I thought to myself, what kind of a defense did this great man get? And when we were waiting for the jury to come back, when the jury was out, he came up and my sister was there. She's back when you're, by the time you go, I'll ring her and say I want you to meet her because she's a retired nurse. We were milling around in the courtroom and Debs was sitting on a chair and he got up and took my sister by the hand and sat her down in the chair. He says, now you sit in that chair and you rest yourself. That's the kind of a man, mm-hmm. instead of thinking about, he didn't know her, you know, but she was a young person, a person. Well, after that, naturally he was found guilty, and my husband and my children made several trips to Canton, Ohio. That's where there's a Canton, a prison there. Mm. And why they took him to Canton, I don't recall. Maybe one of the speeches that they arrested him on was the one that he made in Canton. That could have been the reason. And we used to stand outside and see him through the window, see this man there. And while he was in jail, the Socialist Party ran him for president. Mm-hmm. And I recall he got a landslide of a vote, you know, for president, you know, while he was in jail. At any rate, so we made a number of visits to him in Canton with the family. Mm-hmm. And all the time I was thinking that I've got to do something about it. Well, I did one thing that's not foolish, but it was better that I did it. I said, I'll go to the principal of some university in Cleveland, Western Reserve or somewhere, and talk with her. I need advice on what I'm planning to do. Because I felt that men like Debs need different kind of lawyers than he had. They need what people call a working class lawyer, what I call a working class lawyer at that time. So I went up to this principal and I told her, I want to take up something. She says, well, do you have anything in mind? I didn't have the courage to tell her I want to take up the study of the law because I say I didn't have my college credits yet even. And I said, well, I want to take something that, they're talking to people. I said, I'd like to talk to people, to a lot of people, to talk. That's what she said. Oh, well, you can take up the public speaking course. I said, is there anything else outside of that? I said, you know. And I was foolish. I was timid about it. Mm-hmm. I said, well, I certainly would like to take up the question of law because people like that have to talk a lot to people. She says, well, you take up anything you take up, just go ahead and educate yourself, and God bless you. I suppose she was sorry for me or something, but she didn't have any confidence in me. But I did. I went to make up my credits, and having in mind that I do want to become a lawyer. Now, in my law class, there were three women. Besides myself, two were about my age. I don't think they were married. Two were about my age, and one was an older one. That is night school, the night school. And that those three, none entered the practice of law. They went to work as secretaries for lawyers. The oldest one of them all, I don't know it, but the other one is secretary of lawyers. And I graduated, as I told you, I graduated the same night I graduated law school, but my oldest son, Jerry, graduated high school. My sister, this one that lives here now, and my youngest son, whom I lost in the plane crash, went to his graduation, and my husband went to my graduation.
Your husband was very supportive of you developing your
life. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. He was very proud of what I was doing.
Now, you were already a socialist then at this point.
At the time that I went to law school, yes. As a matter of fact, when Charles Ruthenberg, remember him?
Right.
Charles Ruthenberg was running for some office, I don't remember, some political office. I attended his meeting, and no, I guess he ran on the Socialist Party ticket. I think he ran for president also on the Socialist Party ticket. I supported him on a campaign for him, now that you bring this campaign for him. But I was married at that time already, see. I was married. I had children.
Now, was your husband a socialist as well?
No, he was not. But it wasn't long before he was. So much so that when we were collecting funds to Tom Mooney, free Tom Mooney, I remember he came home one day shaking a box. I said, "You can't hear it, can you?" He says, "You know why? Because it's so full." He says, "I'll bet I collected more money than the youngsters did." I says, "I'm sure you did, you know." And he was very proud of it, yes. He was a socialist, all right.
When the Socialist Party split and the Communist Labor Party was formed in 1919, did you then become a member of the Communist Labor Party?
I'll tell you, when I started to practice law, when I started to practice law, there was a split. What were they? Were they Bolsheviks and Mensheviks, or what were they? Oh, no, those were the Russians.
There was a Foster fight.
Well, I went with the Foster group. See, that's how much I know. I went to the Foster group. And when I opened my office in 806, it was 806 and 808, I rented a room. One room from the attorneys, Clark, one was named Clark, and something else. And something, I don't know what means anything or not, but just about that time, when I opened my law office, there was a rush in Florida. I don't know what the people were rushing for there.
Oh, there was that land
The land boom. My husband and a cousin of his, they went to Florida because things here had gone bad in Cleveland. Very bad, and things weren't any better with us than with other people. At any rate, so he went there, and this is the time that he went right after my graduation, see. And it was in his absence that I looked for a room, for an office, and printed announcements of the practice of law and all that. And when all the invitations were sent out, I brought from home a large sewing basket. It was about this wicker basket, large sewing basket with unmended stockings for my boys. They always wore the stockings too in the knees. they needed mending, and I had no time. And while I went to school, at times I did have help in the house. But she wouldn't mend stockings. She said, "Mrs. Land, I don't mend stockings for my own children. Don't expect me to mend any for yours." So she didn't. But I took it along. I said, "Here's a chance for me to do my mending." And I got mail in response to my announcements. And one was a letter from a Dr. Cohen, C-O-A-N, and he was not Jewish, but his name was Cohen. And he says, "Dear Mrs. Land, I received your announcement, and I thought before you get too busy for this kind of work, if you're willing to handle collections, people owe me a lot of money, I'll be very happy to have you do it, see." So I gave him a ring and I told him, talked with him. I said, "Does that mean that I have to take the last dollar away from people in order to pay you an old debt? Is that what this means?" He says, "No, it means that you'll use your judgment where to do it and where to let them alone." I says, "All right, bring in all your papers and I'll see what I can do." And so I started on that work, and a lot of people came to my office, and I talked with them and found out what their condition was. And one of the condition was such that it didn't warrant giving the last few dollars mm-hmm. to an old, I think he was a dentist, a doctor. I'm not mm-hmm. sure, but I think it was a dentist. At any rate, I used my judgment, and I says, "I'm going to, now I get this straight, I'm not taking you to court for this. I'm not looking for any judgments against you, but do what you can, and I will be reasonable. I'll talk to them." I was old enough to know how to talk that time. And what I want to tell you is, not only did I get a clientele out of this batch of debtors, but I never got to mend the stockings. I never got time to mend the stockings because he sent in this pack of work, and I went to work on it right away. I couldn't afford to let anything grow under my feet or grass grow under my feet. And among these people, mind you, there are some people who were members of the International Labor Defense. There were unemployed people that were not members of the International Labor Defense. There were all kinds of people that were running into difficulties with the law. And so, before I knew it, the Secretary of the International Labor Defense came in and had a talk with me. He says, "Mrs. Land, you think you'd have time to handle some of these ILD cases?" I says, "Time or no time, that's going to be my priority. If you really want me to handle it, you know I'm a new lawyer. And while their civil rights are at stake, they're more important than money matters. So they should have an experienced lawyer." He says, "Well, it's up to them to take their chances on you. It's up to them to know." Mm-hmm. Well, at any rate, I can't begin to tell you how fast things were moving, you know. And Cleveland is not a village, but it was a very common thing for a man or a woman to come in and say, "Are you Mrs. Land? You get a land of law, yeah? Well, I heard about you, and they said you're a very honest lawyer." Well, that is good. But later they start coming and talking to me what a wonderful lawyer I am, you know, how I do things for them. And I don't have to tell you the old stuff of having satisfied customers, how it makes you feel, especially in this case where I was not dealing with money. I had the cases for money matters involved also, because I couldn't live what I got from the ILD. The ILD couldn't afford to pay me.
Right. You took other kinds of...
I took other cases, yes. but came in, and I started with three strikes against me. Do you know Joseph North?
No, I don't.
No, well, he's a columnist, and he came to Cleveland one time, I think the summer, in later years, and he wanted me to gather material for a book, you know, write a book. I said, I can give you the title for the book, but not the material. I have no time. And what's that? This is three strikes. I start with three strikes against me. And he says, well, what does that mean? And so I told him, and I'll tell you now. You start out with practice law, you get assignment cases. They assign to a new lawyer, and they pay him $20 for a case. I received an assignment for a woman who, I'm not going to go into that because it's politically it's not significant, but one young man that stole some money and anyhow won the case for him, and it was an assignment, and we sat till about 11 o'clock at night for the jury to come in, and during that time the judge called me over and the prosecutor. He says, would you two go out on the public square and see if you can pick up a bale of hay, and I'll call in the jury and feed it to them. It was so obvious to this judge that the guy is guilty, you know. Well, they came back with a verdict of not guilty. And his grandmother, when she got the, he was raised by grandmother, got down on her knees and said, Lord, oh Lord, I knew you would free him. I knew, Lord, you would do it. And somebody was telling by, you had nothing to do with Mrs. Landidge. It was the Lord that freed him. Anyhow, that is that. But I got to thinking that I would like to work with women and children, with the poor, women and children, as a lawyer. How do you do it? There was an outfit that was called Clark and Costello, and they were called the Legal Aid Society. So I went over there to talk to them, and I told them how long I'd been practicing or how short, so forth. And what other reference? Have you any reference? I said, no, but I think I can get satisfactory reference. He said, well, you do and come back tomorrow. I knew the presiding judge in the Court of Appeals. His name was, I don't know, his first name or his last name was Levine, a Jewish judge. And he was the presiding judge in the Ohio, in the County Court of Appeals. And I told him what I need the reference for. Well, he called in his secretary. I talked to him during the lunch hour or something. He called in his secretary, and he dictated a letter. It was a beautiful letter. I was pleased. And I went the next day with this letter, and they looked at it as well. You come highly recommended to us. Let me take it up with my partners. And I came back the next day. And the next day, the same man, I don't know whether it was Clark or Costello, one of them, so Mrs. Land, as I told you yesterday, you come highly recommended to us, but you come to us with three strikes against you.
Let me stop.